In the aftermath of the other Kamui's birth and Kotori's death, Kamui shuts down completely. The last time we saw a character this withdrawn was at the end of Tokyo Babylon. Can Tsubaru do something to change this ending for the better, or will he only make it worse?
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. Robin.
Oh God. Every time, every check-in that we've had this year has been like this. Has involved us just saying so and then just like laughing sadly.
Yeah, it's so it's July 2020.
It sure is.
Which should tell you everything you need to know, you future person.
Yeah. It is
hopefully not things we don't know yet.
Yeah. It is still virus times, and America is hopefully in the middle of a revolution, and I am so tired. Like, I'm so tired. We're trying to, like, be helpful and proactive and, like, do things while also not endangering anybody with viruses. It's rough. It's rough.
Yeah, and we're trying to talk about important things, but also give people some much-needed entertainment, but also not cloud out voices that we need to be listening to more right now, and it's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. It also feels like a million years since we watched the X movie and talked about that with, like, my brother, and it hasn't been. Like, it's really, it's like we're pretty much on schedule, but which we weren't for a while, but we're kind of like trying to claw together that normalcy so that we're not just floating in a void of horror. But yeah.
And it feels like a billion years since we talked about the last volume of X.
Oh, goodness. So yeah, I hope that, like, it's probably not nearly as weird for anybody listening. They can go back and listen to the last one or whatever, but, like, it definitely feels a little weird. Reading it, however, I was right back in it. I had no problem. Mm-hmm. And it is going to be really interesting to talk about this volume after having watched the movie, and we'll kind of get into why that is. I don't know. Do you have any other news, anything else we need to share before we start giving our background on Volume 9 of X?
Yeah, I don't think so. I do agree that, like, I felt right back into it once we were reading it. And I think this volume actually does a good job of reminding you everything that happened in the previous, you know, set of everything. Like, earlier on, it felt a little stinted whenever they were like, remember the Sumeragi clan or whatever. But in this one, it felt like they actually rolled the summary or, like, the, like, reminders into the narrative really well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I wonder, it is possible that some of that is because we actually needed that information. but I also agree that this one felt pretty, like, this felt pretty tight in some ways. And the ways in which it's sort of loose, we'll talk about as well. All right, so we're on Volume 9, baby.
Woohoo!
Warning. If you have not read Tokyo Babylon or listened to our episodes about it, this one will make no sense and be an entire pile of spoilers. I pity anyone who was reading Just X at the time, which did, of course, include our past selves. We definitely read this volume before we read all of Tokyo Babylon. I do think it sets up their relationship pretty well, but somebody explaining, oh, Seishido pretended to be nice and made Tsubaru fall in love with him and then revealed himself to be a murderer. Like, that is not as impactful as being along for the ride for that whole story, where you actually feel those things happening instead of just being told that that's what happened.
Yeah, and it loses a lot of the nuance of Seishido, especially so far.
Like, yes. Well, I mean, just in this volume. I think also, like, it sort of goes without saying at this point, but it doesn't. Like, content warning for basically all of the rest of X. Like, there's a lot of gore. There's a lot of discussions of, like, abusive relationships kind of stuff. Like, everything. These are rough. Like, these are intense. And it does not let up. Okay.
Yeah.
But to be a little more technical, the Japanese tankobon came out in either, I think, actually January 1997. Though, for some reason, my actual volume of, like, my English volume says that it came out originally in, like, December 1996, So my sources are conflicting, but I'm pretty sure it is actually 1997. So that is at least 6 months after the previous volume. And if we've been talking about like this kind of middle era of X, it has been almost like 6 months to a year between each volume instead of 3 months, instead of the 3 months that was, you know, how the original like first few volumes came out. That was the schedule they originally had that they just could not do. For many, many reasons. I don't know, like working on helping with the film production and then working on what became one of their biggest and most important other comic series at the same time. I don't know, that kind of spreads your schedule out a little bit. But it is 6 months this time, not like a whole year. So that's, you know, do a little better. Importantly, though, the X movie came out in August of 1996. So that is between volume 8 and 9. So while maybe the first like couple chunks of pages of this may have run in the magazine before the movie came out, almost everything in this volume came out, like, would have been read after fans had already seen the movie. That is a lens through which to view this that I find both interesting and totally unavoidable, because I also saw the movie before I read this entire chunk. And there almost does feel like there's a slight shift here, even though the pages, like, start exactly where the last volume left off. I sort of do think that there's a little bit of shift, and we'll talk about that. Of course, the English language volume originally came out in 2002. Both Japanese and American releases had an olive green toned piece of Satsuki with her usual wires and beast in the background as the cover illustration. The American release is called Requiem, which, good job, localization team. That's a pretty cool choice here. The Japanese front flap has Satsuki as the hermit for the tarot card with the Hebrew letter Samek.
So as we kind of jump into the plot, we pick off right where volume 8 left off. Kamui just made his choice to be a dragon of heaven, which of course he did to protect Kotori and Fuma, but unfortunately this triggered the full takeover of what we're calling Dark Fuma slash other Kamui, who then stabbed Kotori. And naturally, Kamui is quite upset by this. Fuma kind of has him pinned up with glass shards in sort of a crucified X form, as opposed to like Kotori's crucified like cross form, and is about to kill him as well. When Kakyo takes possession of Kotori's body, and her eyes go all cat-eyed with the cool little irises, and says that she wouldn't want Kamui to die, Fuma observes that this must be the work of a powerful dream seer who must be a dragon of Earth. And this creates enough of a diversion that the rest of the Kamui crew arrives. It's Sorata, Arashi, Aoki, Yuzuriha, Subaru, and Saiki, whose name I had to look up because I'm a horrible person.
Yeah, we're jerks.
I almost put him in our notes as that nose guy, Robin.
Oh no, that's terrible. I also, yeah. Like, I don't know, if there is ever a character who I think is actually an interesting character with an interesting role in the story, but is probably the first person who would need to be cut from this cast, I'm sorry, Psyche, it's you.
Yeah, it's you.
He's
sorry, man.
Totally interesting and, like, used really well, but also probably should have been one of the other main characters doing all those
yeah.
things.
Yeah. Everybody arrives, so Fuma pieces out. After telling Kamui to remember that he, Fuma, is the one that will kill him, Kamui. And when he leaves, a bunch of wires spring up around Kotori and also cut her to pieces, leaving her head at Kamui's feet. And I wasn't entirely clear if this wire thing was being done by him.
I think that I think that those were the wires she was already strung up by. Like, I think that like, tightened it. Because we've seen that in the Kotori visions, like, of her own death multiple times. It's exactly how she keeps dreaming, or kept dreaming. Whoops, past tense now. Sorry, Kotori. It's how she kept, like, dreaming that she was going to die.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, both visions of her death have now been fulfilled. I mean,
yeah.
I guess death and then, you know, post-death decapitation.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Poor thing.
Yeah. Poor one out, everybody.
So anyway, yeah, it's hard. So Kamui muscles through the glass shards that are pinning him to the rubble so that he can cradle Kotori's head, which is much the way he did Tokiko's earlier in the manga.
Also note, this is how the movie ended, but with Fuma's head. So we just have a whole head cradling theme here. And oh boy, that, like, I'm pretty sure that left an imprint on me. I don't know definitely. That it's ever gonna, like, come up in my work, but it does mean that I have this, like, instant connection with that, being like, oh yeah, no, sometimes when things are really rough, you just keep cradling the disembodied head of someone you love. Mm. Boy, that's a weird thing.
Yeah, and with the movie having just come out, or possibly come out, like, possibly right after this volume aired in a magazine, like, all around then, it's kind of unavoidable that you would compare them and see that parallel. So I think that that's an interesting and, like, powerful image that they made right there.
Yeah. We do also have the Conway just screaming. The screaming, no, which is kind of where the movie ended.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the scene cuts to, is him just screaming.
So we next move on to Kanoe and Hinoto doing some sort of, like, summarizing of everything going on from their respective layers, which, like, this does happen periodically. Like, thank you, Dreamseer sisters, for occasionally just telling us what's up and trying to, you know, set everything out on the table for us.
Yeah, that was maybe the one part of, like, a reminder of the plot that felt a little bit more heavy-handed in this volume.
They do it a lot, though, and so at some point you're just like, oh yeah, we haven't heard from them in a while.
Yeah, oh, they're here.
But then we sort of move to yet another dream space, but this is what is referred to as Kotori's death dream. And Kotori is thanking Kakyo for intervening on her behalf, and explains that she knew if Uma killed Kamui, he'd never be able to come back from that. She reminds us that if Kamui was in danger, she wanted to be the one to break. And we get a beautiful panels where we see the sort of, like, shattered glass from all of her visions of the earth shattering. Mm-hmm. And those shards,
so pretty.
It's so pretty. And those shards gather and, like, become, like, feathered wings for her. It's really nice comicking. Mm-hmm. She says goodbye to Kakyo, who reveals that he also lost the person that he loves, and he wishes to join that person in death, but if he took his own life, he wouldn't be able to. And she gets to see his face, too, which I guess she hadn't really seen, like, fully seen what his face looked like normally, and says that he has beautiful gold eyes. She does leave before she sort of, like, flies off with her glass feather wings. She leaves a last message for him to at some point deliver to Kamui and Fuma, and the message is that she loves them and that the future has yet to be decided. Kakyo then has some kind of helpful monologuing about the state of things, and he summarizes the two sides. He says that, oh no, if the dragons of heaven triumph, humans will survive, but will consume the earth, and we get an image that is sort of like a very extreme version of desertification, because Tokyo's just covered in sand, and like, okay. And then if the dragons of earth triumph, humanity crumbles and the earth survives, and then it's all like the earth is reclaiming all the buildings and everything. Hmm. He says there can only be one future, and the decision is in Kamui's hands. And oh boy, is that a little confusing, because we feel like he already has made a decision. We were told that Kamui had made a decision and now everything was decided. And even Kakyo, who's very, very fatalistic, like, he does think the future has been decided, is still sort of acting like it's in the air, but he thinks it's only up in the air between these two options. And I think that here he's sort of implying that this is up to the two Kamuis determining which one wins. Like, I think that that is what he is going for with
this.
Yeah,
like, the decision is up to the Kamuis at this point, not singular Kamui.
Yeah.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Kamui is unresponsive, and the Kamui crew has gotten him back to an infirmary somewhere at the Clamp School. There's a panel setting the stage for this with the Clamp School pentacle in the background, but he's still holding Kotori's head. His eyes are open and he's alive, but he is not at home in there. He's basically catatonic. Where have we seen this scenario before?
I wonder.
And he's also got, like, he's just got the dead anime eyes going on. Sudata comments on the horrible situation, seeing the girl you love killed by your best friend, and Subaru has some Seishiro flashbacks, and buckle up for more of this, guys.
It's handled in this incredible shoujo comics layouts in this section. They're layering these long, thin panels that are just slices of Subaru's past with slices of what's happening in the moment. It's beautiful and it's heart-wrenching, and if you already know Tokyo Babylon really well, you're like, oh god, no, those moments, no, we totally know, like, we totally know what is going on in his head.
Yeah, it's so well done. It, like, I think it worked really well on me before I knew what was going on with Tsubudu's past anyway. Like, I think it works either way, but it is especially poignant if you know what's happening. So, remember when this happened to Tsubudu? Tsubudu remembers when this happened to Tsubudu. He remembers that when he went catatonic like this, his sister left and confronted Seishiro, and she died. He also remembers that he can dive into the mind of a traumatized person, as he did in Dream in Volume 2 of Tokyo Babylon. The others tell him it's too dangerous, his own mind could be harmed, but Tsubudu is determined. After some difficulty getting into his mind, Tsubudu is able to get to the core of Kamui's consciousness. He sees that Kamui is reliving the moment when he made his decision and Dark Fuma emerged, which is also handy for new readers that need a reminder. He keeps watching her death and also seeing memories of when they were little kids, abruptly destroyed by Dark Fuma rising out of Kid Fuma's split open body. Oh. It is legitimately horrible. And they are surrounded by dream feathers when Tsubudu makes contact with Kid Kamui. It's just, it's all so gorgeous. Like, it's gory and kind of difficult, but so pretty.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, this whole volume, I think, their art was starting to take a little bit of a shift here. And you can definitely see that there are things that might have been more stiff earlier that are more flowy here. But I also think that it's a little bit less a tour de force in terms of using the, like, most incredible detailed toner techniques. Like, there's just a little bit of them, like, not filling every single panel with as much action as possible. It's great. It's just, it's a very interesting volume. And I'm not saying that this one is, like, less elaborate. It's that I think they're kind of maybe picking and choosing a little bit. There are a lot of double page and full page spreads that are just emotional impact here, too. Lots of them. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it feels to me like we're getting to the story that they've been wanting to tell all along, and so, like, they're finally in it, and you can kind of feel that triumph on the pages.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so back in reality, so by which we mean not anybody's dream or or whatever, or psyche, Dark Fuma, other Kamui, tracks Kakyo down to a Four Seasons hotel.
I know. That took me out of it for a moment. It was just so entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like I've been to anime conventions and Four Seasons hotels, so it's just funny. Anyway, yeah. And crashes into his room. I would like to note that before that scene happens, we had the maids, like, gossiping about how his room is off limits because it's being used by politicians for shady business. And it's delightful because you're like, oh no, I don't think that's exactly what's going on here, but who knows? And I'm not sure, like, I don't know, like, at some point we get a little more background on Kakyo, but I would not be surprised if he was actually, like, related to a politician or something. Something happened, like, this person is hooked up to very expensive life support and probably has been for a lot of his life. And that is, I mean, like, I'm not sure that even Japanese medicine is able to pay for some rando to have that going on. Maybe they are. We live in America. We have the worst healthcare system ever. So yeah, I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, he must be rich in order to still be alive. And, like, I don't know. Not every country does that.
That's true. I think at this point in the story, I did just assume that he was kind of being used in a way similar to how Hinata was being used.
Yeah, it does kind of seem like it. And he may have even mentioned something about this. We'll come back to this as we discuss the mystery and solutions to Kakyo throughout the next few volumes. But, so, he is, of course, completely vulnerable. Like, he can't really move particularly, but Kakyo welcomes Fuma into his dreamscape. And I'm not even sure if it was welcomes, exactly. Like, he brings him into it, and it might even be a defense just as much as it is anything else.
Yeah, it felt more like his initial shield or whatever.
Yeah. But he does show him Kid Kamui crying over the loss of Kotori and Fuma, complete with the feathers, exactly like what Tsubudu was seeing at the same time. He passes on Kotori's last message, that she loves them, and that the future is yet undecided, but Fuma insists that the future has been set since the moment he became a Dragon of Earth, and there can only be one future. He breaks through Kakyo's dream, back into the hotel room, and, like, definitely puts his hand on Kakyo's throat. It is, like, a definite threat. And he tells him that it's time for him to join the Dragons of Earth, and Kakyo is going to be his dream seer.
Yeah, and so back in Kamui's dream, Tsubudu tells Kamui who he is, and Kid Kamui doesn't recognize him. I honestly can't remember if they've met yet.
Yeah, not particularly.
Yeah, if they have, it hasn't been for, like, a deep conversation or anything. And Kid Kamui begs him not to kill Kotori and Fuma. And he and the dream are just melting into feathers, like, in front of Subaru, and it's just gorgeous. As we keep saying, kind of a broken record, but it's just all so gorgeous, guys. Subaru tells him that if he stays in this dream, nothing new will begin and nothing will ever end. He's running away from reality, trying to avoid his decision. And he would know! So Subaru goes on to tell him about Seishiro. How he was in love with Seishiro, and for a year, Seishiro was incredibly kind and even lost sight in one eye protecting Subaru. But then he told Subaru that he didn't distinguish between people and things, which is sort of a simplification of that, but whatever. Yeah. Kamui adorably asks if he means that he meant that things have lives just like people do. And this feels like a very Shinto thing to me.
Yeah, but it's also like a direct parallel to Subaru asking whether the bodies under the cherry trees are hurting. And in this scene, older Subaru's face, when he hears Kamui ask that question, is almost exactly the same as young Seishiro's face when baby Subaru asked that question.
Oh, you're so right. Oh,
yeah, I know. Heartbreak. So heartbreak.
Oh, but of course, unfortunately, he meant the more serial killer version of this, that he'd destroy a living creature as easily as an object. So he shows Seishiro killing Hokuto, and just as feathers seem to compose the figures in Kamui's dreams, Sakura petals do the same in Subaru's. Subaru explains that he couldn't stop Seishiro because he was in a similar state to Kamui, shut off from the world, trying to avoid reality.
Subaru has a couple more lines in here about his own situation, that he has had to decide that he's going to do something that has the slightest possibility of making him happy, even if it makes everyone else who cares about him hate him. He does not tell us what this is. He also describes what will happen to Kamui if he stays stuck in this place. Every time he watches the same tragedy repeat, he'll break more, become colder. Subaru says he himself is so broken and so cold.
And in a moment where he's almost his youthful self, Subaru emphasizes that while there are similarities, their pain is not the same, because losing his sister is what brought him back to the world. He realized that if he wanted to make his wish a reality, which we still don't know what his wish is, he had to keep on living, because Seishiro is special to him, as Kamui points out. Subaru tells Kamui he has a decision to make, to stay shut down or wake up and work to make his own wish a reality. And Kamui tells us here that he wants to save Fuma. Kotori is already gone, but Fuma might still be in there somewhere, and he emphasizes that the person doing these things is not Fuma. Like, he's very aware that this is other Kamui, or as we've been calling him, Dark Fuma. This is not his Fuma. And Subaru points out that if real Fuma does come back, he'll remember being the one who killed Kotori. And his solution is that Kamui should tell Fuma that he was the one that killed her instead. And Kamui, a confused teenager...
Yeah, we will come back to this because this is obviously wild. Like, yeah, this is obviously wild. We, like, a lot of our discussion for this volume is just going to be talking about what was this advice. But okay, but we're in the moment. We're in the moment.
Yeah. So, Kamui agrees that he'll take the blame for Kotori's death, even if everyone hates him and doesn't understand what really happened. And Subaru tells him to come back to them. And...
Dark Fuma then senses that Kamui is back.
Dun dun dun.
He has Kakyo show him where Kamui and Subaru are, in Kamui's soul or whatever. And this is another thing that I think will be worth bringing up later as well. Like, how do death dreams and dream spaces and people's psyches connect? I'm not sure that that is ever explained in this, but there's definitely a sense that they are connected, that it's all the same kind of like unconscious, like subconscious space. But Kakyo, like, totally explains, like, what Kamui's goal is now, which is that it is to bring back the real Fuma. Fuma asks Kakyo what his wish is, and he says he wishes only for death, which Fuma is happy to offer him.
So as Subaru brings Kamui back, the dreams melt, and Kamui and Dark Fuma see each other. Dream feathers reverberate through the dramatic moment, highlighting the seals on Tokyo, like the different buildings that represent the, like, the kekais of the city or whatever.
Yes, don't forget that that is still a very important element in this story.
Yeah, there are physical locations that are still very important. And then as Kamui wakes up, Subaru collapses on him, and he holds Subaru in kind of this hug, but they're both kind of weak, and thanks him, and it is just adorable.
It's a really sweet scene. Like, Subaru goes from being like, hey, we did it, as everybody is like, whoa, Kami's waking up, and then he just passes out, like, in an instant. And it is, like, it is really sweet, because Kami does, like, embrace him. Like, these are people who did not know each other, and they have now shared this incredibly important and traumatic thing. Like, they have this weird trauma bonding moment where, like, you're like, oh yeah, no, they are forever going to be connected here. It's sweet, except Kotori's head is still in this frame, guys.
Like, yeah, it's hard. Like, there. Maybe he was comatose and crazy and they didn't want to, like, take it away from him, but I feel like maybe someone should have been like, no.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Oh. But so after this kind of, like, dream severing, Fuma, we see, has Kakyo, and he's being directed by him to Konoe's lair.
Yeah. So, some time passes after this. It is nebulous as to how long or how immediate any of the danger still is, which is a little confusing considering how tense the early volumes were about, like, this is about to happen. We're like, okay, well, how long is any of this taking? But it's also very important for us to have a moment of rest because of how intense everything has been. So, we see Kamui visiting this big, beautiful tree under which Kotori has been buried, and we're definitely still on the Clam School campus. Mm-hmm. All of the seven seals show up, and they all introduce themselves to him, because the group of them have never been in the same place all together.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Kaden has not really been part of the group, but she shows up here and introduces herself. There's a cute little moment where she already knows Aoki, and everyone's like, how do you know Aoki? And they make a joke about him being one of her clients, but he explains, oh, it's while he was doing research for somebody's manga for the publisher. And you're like, okay, sure. Kaden delivers her message from Tokiko, which was just protect the sacred sword, which, I mean, good job, everybody. And they talk about how Tokiko told them to hide the sacred sword at the heart of Clamp Campus until the day that is to come. You know, the day when the end of the world is decided. The fate of the world. Maybe it's the end of the world, maybe not. We don't know. The fate of the world. The Clamp Campus detectives, although that is probably not what they call themselves anymore, pop out of a bush to show them where to take the sword. It is wild, folks. It is like a comedic beat in this very serious volume. And they all have, like, pretty serious faces immediately afterward. But in the panel where they all just pop out, they are literally popping out of bushes. Like, as though they were like, oh, this is a really important moment and we shouldn't crash it. But they were still, like, spying on them. Oh, boy.
It's a moment that makes them definitely feel like they're still the Clamp Campus detectives. Yeah. Like, fully mature men or whatever.
Yeah, it's wild. Okay, so the only missing seal, Hinoto herself, is having a dream conversation with Kakyo, as you do. Yeah. I mean, that's the only kind of conversation you're going to have with Kakyo, so it happens.
And kind of with Hinoto, for the most part.
It's like, true. Both of them, this is just sort of the life they have. It's fine. Hmm. It's probably not fine. In fact, I think the comic is pretty clear that it is not fine, and neither of them are particularly happy with the situation.
Yeah.
But still, she asks why he joined Dark Fuma when he knows what's going to happen. And he says he's just doing his job in order to make his wish come true, just like she's been spinning lies in order to get her own wish. This is the first time we've had any hints about this, and Hinoto seems just as surprised as the reader that anyone knows about the dark secret she has apparently been keeping this whole time. She cries out, breaking out of her dream, and all of her underlings react to it. And that is the end of this volume.
Yeah. I do feel like Konoe hinted at this at some point.
Yes. But we never exactly, like, I agree that, like, maybe Konoe kind of had some, like, ooh, is this really what you want? But it didn't necessarily imply that she had, like, a dark, evil secret so much as that, oh, things are not exactly what you're saying. Or, like, oh, you've been a little dissembling. And we know she was a little dissembling in the beginning. You know, she was doing a lot of manipulative things, which we pointed out a lot. Like, ooh, she's sure showing Kamui horrible visions to try to get him to do a specific thing. Like, that's pretty terrible. But this is the first time that anyone has just called her out, and oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. So after the main part of the volume has ended, we get another short, as we have for the last few of them. And this one is Kusanagi's, And we get to see a continuation of the scene where he and Yuzuriha met, which miraculously made it into the movie. Like,
yeah.
They managed to do this scene in the movie, which really impressed me. Because it's such a good scene. Anyway, they have this cute little bit about how both their names, Kusanagi Shiyu and Yuzuriha Nekoi, sound like their given and surnames have been reversed. Because, like, their surnames are kind of shorter, whereas their, like, given names are a little bit longer. And that just... It's one of those jokes that I kind of get because I speak enough Japanese, but it's probably much funnier if you are actually Japanese. So he explains that he works in the self-defense forces.
That is the army in Japan, the SDF, which is not technically supposed to have a standing army. There were restrictions put on its armed forces by the U.S., and not just the U.S., but let's face it, mostly the U.S. after World War II. That is a lot of geopolitical stuff to even begin to think about here, so we'll probably go into that more later when Kusanagi shows up more, but oh my goodness, it's the SDF. Like, it's fine. He is a soldier.
So she explains to him about Inuki, and he points out that it can be hard for anyone who is gifted with abilities that set them apart, but those abilities bring joy, too, and hasn't she always had a lot of good times with Inuki? And she has, and she's very sad but happy about that point. And he goes on to say that from here on, things are going to get tougher, but she should remember that she's got a lot of good things waiting for her too, which, oh, my heart.
Yeah.
And he also reveals his thing, which is that he can hear the voices of trees, insects, even flowers. And when humans destroy them in the name of progress, he hears them screaming. And it causes him a lot of pain, but it also lets him be friends with them. And
he has a Disney princess moment where he's just like collecting little birds on his fingers and stuff.
Yeah, he really does. Beautiful. It's like a Disney princess slash Kotori moment, which is especially.
Except he is like a JoJo. It's great.
Yeah, he's great. He says he'll walk her to the station, and she asks if they'll see each other again, and he says they will.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. So we have a lot to discuss here, and I think I brought up a couple little things where, like, about how I think that there is something slightly weird about the pacing here, where, like, the first maybe 5 or 6 volumes are so, like, something big is about to happen, and the Kekkei are gonna fall, and, like, it's very immediate and tense, and at this point something huge has happened, but it's totally personal to the main characters, and the story slows down a little bit, and I think that the timeline is confused. And I don't know, like, did that bother you at all?
And not so much in this volume, anyway. There was so much momentum at this point that I was just kind of, like, in it. But, yeah, it does feel like we could have... Well, we've talked about how pacing could have been adjusted earlier on, but, yeah, it does feel like the big things that are happening, like, it's kind of hard to tell how much... the impact is on the rest of the world. Like, there was a moment where they're in the rubble and everything is going down with, you know, Fuma and Kotori and everything, and it feels like we are in that future where everything is decimated, but then it all kind of goes back to reality after that. Like, everything except for that one spot is pretty normal.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure what, like, the world is doing to deal with this disaster, I guess, that just happened.
I think that's an interesting point. And something that we're going to kind of, like, that's a thread we're going to get back to a little later in this discussion, too. But speaking of that, like, I was just so in it that it's hard to notice. That thing that I said about how, like, oh, somehow Kamui's psyche and future dreams and somebody's death dream, somehow all of these spaces are, like, the same space for people like Kakyo and Hinoto. And I think that there is no explanation whatsoever for how they are connected. There isn't really any, like, sci-fi or fantasy explanation for that in this. There's just sort of the, like, half of everything going on in X is in vision space. Like, it's not a real thing happening. It is either a prognostication of the future or a very, like, a dream that is sort of metaphorical, but maybe not completely metaphorical, and whether or not you can trust any of these things is so nebulous. And sometimes I feel like X is handling that on purpose, where it's trying to say that, yes, these people believe that there is a future that is specific because they keep seeing these visions, and so they're going to kind of, like, make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, that is definitely one of the themes going on in X. But sometimes I feel like it's a little bit of an almost, like plot hole, like, writing problem, where if so much of what's going on is just what people are thinking and feeling, and it's taking on these really big things, but there's also actual world-shaking, real disasters happening outside, it can be a little confusing as to which of those is more important. They kind of take time and space away from each other, and it's not that they never synergize. They definitely do. At its best, sometimes this story is just, like, an incredible way to sort of see both the big things happening to the whole world, and then seeing them also visited on the individual characters on the inside, and it's a cool parallel, and it all works together. But there are moments where I feel like, oh, it's almost just convenience that we are always able to, like, that different characters can see each other's visions all the time, and that the moments where they have to communicate those things to the people who don't see the visions, like, those moments happen too, and that feels like a bit of a pacing problem. That if we can share visions, why are we doing it over and over and over again? Why don't we just all do it, like, have that happen once in the story, and then everyone's on the same page? Like, what does it add to the story to have to bring everybody up to speed? In the X movie, there's this whole thing where Konoe is very active. Like, she is actively seeking these characters, or they're actively seeking her, and everything kind of comes together, and, like, the villain side feels much more villainous.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're not necessarily villainous in the manga. That is definitely one of the things that they're going for, is that she's not, I mean, like, she's pretty iffy in some ways, but not necessarily just straight up evil.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this whole thing where Kakyo, oh my goodness, as a character, he does not exist at all in the movie. Mm-hmm. And his role in this is very strong, but it also is a role that I wonder, like, does it need to exist? He bridges all these gaps that Kotori could have been doing, that Hinoto could have been doing. I love this character. I don't know. I have, like, weirdly romanticized this character, which is iffy in some ways, too. Like, I loved this character when I was a teenager.
I'm really attached to him. And I feel like I remember him being such a big deal, probably because he wasn't in the movie. So when we finally got to this part of the manga, it was, like, the first new thing.
Yeah, it felt like a big deal. You're like, oh, it's a big revelation, right? You're like, who is the other one? Similarly to how finding out that Kendappa was the last of the stars in Rigveda, right? Like, we're like, you're waiting for this moment. But there's still this thing where, like, Fuma has to break Kakyo out of his life support to use him as a dowsing rod to find Konoe. And that feels like, for a story where there are all of these active characters with powers, it feels weird that we would need to step back and do that.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that the dreamscape melding stuff, I mean, it may be slightly inconsistent, but I think that it has been, there's been more crossing with Kakyo.
True. He does cross them. That is him who's making that happen, isn't it?
Yeah, like, because Hinoto can have them. Konoe can, like, eavesdrop in hers, but can't have them herself. But I think Kakyo, and maybe Kotori, but it seems more Kakyo is the one who can actually, like, affect and meld other people's dreams. So it feels like that's a new thing in their little, like, logic of the universe.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point. I think that my thing still stands that I'm like, oh, I sort of wish that almost everything Kakyo does, Kotori had done, but I can see how that makes it a drastically different story. And again, I love Kakyo. Don't get me wrong. I love this character. But I wonder that if I had to sit down and, like, pick and choose which elements to keep. But it was also funny because as I'm sitting here talking about how all of the melding dreamscapes is kind of weird and inconsistent, you don't notice when you're reading it. You only notice when you have to describe what's happening. Because when you're reading it, it is so visually contiguous. Like, it makes total sense. Like, each of them have different ways that their visions look. Their spaces are different. They have different things that are good and bad, which, again, you know, I'm sort of trying to keep track of these visual motifs and elements, and then we're going to have a big discussion about that around the end of the series, because I think until then, I just don't have enough data. But, yeah. Like, it's interesting. Like, they command the visuals for these so well that it really doesn't quite, like, it doesn't, I don't think anyone would notice on a first read that some of these things are a little weird. I think it's really just when we're trying to talk about, well, where are we now? Well, we're not in a place, we're in Kamui's brain. Well, how is Kakyo in Kamui's brain? I don't know. He's in, not only in Kamui's brain, but Subaru is also there. But is he visible to Kakyo? I'm not entirely sure he was. I don't know. It's a little weird. It's not even necessarily a flaw. It's one of those differences between, like, how a comic, which is a very visual thing, can work. But if you were writing this as a novel, you would really have to approach it differently.
Yeah, like, it didn't feel at all strange in context. And this one was a little hard to summarize because there were so many things going on simultaneously that they were just jumping back and forth. And so it made it
and
a little
it flows beautifully on the pages.
Yeah.
But it does make it a little difficult to figure out where a scene begins and ends when you're like, okay, we're switching to a different perspective now. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes total sense in, like, visually, like, to read it. Totally fine.
Yeah. And I'm curious to see when we eventually get to the anime how stuff like this is handled, because I don't really remember it very well. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah. No, it is really cool. Like, one thing about having just watched the movie and then reading this is you're like, oh yeah, this story has been told like 3 times. Mm-hmm. And that means that no matter what, we're going to compare these things. It is also really interesting to think that from here on out, like, the film did sort of end with a scene kind of like this. Like, it didn't go on that much longer past Kotori dying. Like, it kind of had, you know, like, it went on a little past that, but not drastically past that. Everything happening in this volume and everything from here on out puts a lot of emphasis on characters that barely mattered in the movie at all. Like, Subaru did the most important thing in this chunk, probably. Mm-hmm. And he was dead for the whole movie. Like, he died in the first few seconds of the movie. Like, that's a huge difference, and it's got to be really an interesting thing to keep in mind when you watch that movie, when you read this, to just be like, wow, the divergence is massive. Like, you cannot tell the same story because you're not even using the same characters. Kakyo and Subaru are so important to all of X, and of course the movie just does not have them. Like, they're just not present, and it lets them focus on the other characters instead.
It does kind of make sense just taking in that context that, like, they weren't in the movie because, like, they're very important, but they haven't done anything yet. Like, totally see why that happened.
Oh, yeah. It was a totally logical decision. It's just really interesting. As you were saying, they weren't there.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't there for the first 7 volumes. All right. So I guess it's time to unpack Subaru's terrible advice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of what the fuck, dude, going on there. And, like, I don't even know. It's also interesting to talk about how this parallels Tokyo Babylon. And I think, like, I originally was like, oh, yeah, we're going to talk about that for a really long time. But, like, no, it's really obvious. Like, that scene is absolutely Subaru saying, like, oh, when this happened to me, my sister died because I wasn't there. Like, I retreated into myself and I couldn't do anything to help. And things are so much worse now, and they wouldn't have been if I had gotten out of that state. And instead of focusing on, oh, what if I had done better, because you really can't go back into the past and change it, he's just like, okay, I'm going to try to fix this. Like, and there are some interesting things, I think, about how it almost casts Kotori as more of a sister figure than a romantic interest.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just that since she is Fuma's sister, she is a sister on some level. But also, like, Lucy, I think it's really interesting how this does a really nice job of giving you, like, it beats you over the head with, like, there is a parallel, everybody. Fuma is Kamui's dark side. I mean, Dark Fuma is Kamui's dark side. And the Sakura Zukamori is the dark side to the Tsunade. Like, that is interesting. And I think it's, from here on out, something they're really excited about focusing on. Like, it is clearly important to the story that they're trying to tell, that there's this parallel between the dark and light side of these two people. And is it four people? Is it really just two people? That's an interesting kind of metaphorical space for them to play in, and I love it. But, like, yeah, I was like, oh, we could talk about that forever. I'm like, well, not really. Like, I think we're good. I think what we're not good with is Subaru's terrible advice.
Yeah, like, I don't remember being mad about this when I was a teenager, so maybe it's coming out as an adult, but I was just like...
I remember being mad about it as a teenager.
Okay, maybe I was, but I don't remember it. But, like, this is just not good advice, my man. Like, I love you, but... Whoa, this logic does not follow for me. Like, on a basic level, so he says Fuma will remember doing it, so how would it be helpful if Kamui was then claiming to do it if Fuma remembers doing it? Like, shouldn't he prepare to be there to support Fuma as he goes through this very trying time?
Yeah, like, it helps. We have the benefit of, like, decades of, like, understanding therapy and trauma responses, right?
Which, yeah.
I don't know, like... I think here's also a moment for just say, why did nobody put Subaru in therapy? I understand that there was a stigma in the 90s, especially in Japan, about therapy. But, like, if anyone needs therapy, it is this person. Like, this person was catatonic for a while, and then everything went even worse for him. Like, why would you not? Why would you not have him talk to somebody? Like, he's traumatized. Like, the word for this is traumatized. There's not, like, solutions to this. Like, people have to deal with this. It is a terrible, real problem for people. But there are approaches that, like, can help you, like, find a way through it. And boy, it just feels like no one did that for him. Like, he just...
Yeah, definitely.
But, like, here's my thing. Subaru and Kamui agree in this, like, for me the wildest part is that they both agree that if Fuma realizes he's responsible for Kotori's death, he'll just break. Like, I think that's already a wild assumption, because you're like, well, Fuma's not the same as both of you. Like, he's a different person. He maybe has a different sense of who he is and what his role is in life. Like, it wouldn't necessarily break him to have to deal with what would have broken you guys. But... you know, it makes sense for them to believe this because it is exactly what happened to them. Mm-hmm. Both of them broke because of the situation. They assume Fuma would act the same way because, like, that's all that they know and understand. My biggest issue, of course, is that Fuma isn't responsible for Kotori's death. He was basically possessed. Now, legally, that is not a defense, okay?
Yeah.
But we are so far from the police having a say in anything. I mean, no one has investigated anything. There are no detectives in the story. There are no white ladies with podcasts. Okay,
well,
you don't have to be a white lady to have a true crime podcast, but I'm just saying, like, no one, like, there is no semblance of the real world intervening at all. And we sort of mentioned that way earlier, right, Lucy, when you were like, oh, it's like sometimes you see the rubble and you almost feel like they've made it into those bad futures, and then you pull back and you're like, oh, the rest of the city's fine. There is a moment here where I would suggest that the whole story has a dreamlike quality because there is no real person in it. This does change a little bit. Like, there are moments where I'm stargazing. I'm stargazing, give me a point.
Oh, because, God, like, I don't have my notes.
But I'm going to finish telling you this, that, like, it does eventually incorporate a little bit of normal people into this story, but it has done so little of that so far, and certainly you're not seeing the emergency response teams. Like, you're not seeing any of the reality of what these disasters would actually wreak on the world. And I think that's kind of interesting. Like, that is something I would point out. I don't know that it is a flaw, but I do think that it, again, gives it a dreamlike quality. It means that everything is as surreal as everything else because the strangeness of their visionscapes is not all that different from the horrors of the real world that they're in. And it's just a bunch of teenagers destroying buildings and killing each other, and it's so wild that no one ever intervenes. An adult never steps up and is like, what the hell is going on here? And a lot of that can be attributed, of course, to them having their battles in these kekkai, so literally no one can see them, but not all the time.
Yeah.
So, okay, back to Subaru's wild, terrible advice. I am going to say here that, like, on the one hand, it's terrible advice. Like, we both just said, like, it's obviously terrible advice. Why would Conway need to lie and say he did something that neither of them are responsible for? Like, this thing happened because fate, destiny, mechanisms, of, like, the machinations of mechanistic, fatalistic determinationism. Like, this is not a thing that happened because Fuma wanted to do it or Conway wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
This happened, and it's terrible. And on some level, like, Fuma shouldn't feel responsible for this. And if he remembers doing it, it doesn't matter what anyone tells him, because Kotori, of course, was told that her mother died in the hospital, but she saw her dismembered in front of her own eyes, and she broke because of that. Why would they think that the lie helps you, when in this case they know as soon as the lie disappears, you just go back to being broken? It's obviously terrible advice. I'm sorry. There's no argument here. It doesn't really work in their own world. But Lucy, I think I do understand why Subaru gives him this advice. On the one hand, it does kind of stem from his own actions, right? Like, he thinks Conway must take on the onus of this murder to protect Fuma, even though in all likelihood it'll just lead Fuma to hating and killing him. Because on some level, that's probably something in the range of what Subaru thinks he's going to do, right? He says that he is going to do something that will make everybody hate him, and it makes sense that on some level he sort of assumes that Conway has to do the same thing. But also, Subaru clearly not only has not been to therapy, he hasn't learned a whole lot since he was a pure-hearted 16-year-old. He still thinks that the only way through is self-sacrifice. It is the only tool in his box. So he obviously advises Conway to do that too, even though it is wild. And I can see how it would make sense to Conway. It is self-flagellating to the extreme. It feels right to someone who feels responsible for a tragedy to imagine that they can take on the guilt and blame themselves, even though it will obviously not help anybody. It makes sense to both of them because they want to believe that they can sacrifice themselves and not have to live with these horrors and let somebody else live without them. It makes total sense that they would want this. It just doesn't make any sense that they could achieve this. I mean, would it be cruel to bring Fuma back? Is it even possible? We don't even know.
Yeah, like, I totally get why it makes sense to Kamui. I kind of get why it makes sense to Subaru. My problem is that, like, this doesn't seem like advice that younger Subaru would ever give to someone else. Like, it seems like a thing he would definitely give to himself, but that if he was, like, counseling someone who was going through this, he wouldn't have advised this for them.
Yeah, no, it definitely is weird for him to make that decision to say to somebody else.
Yeah, and like, to me, it's wild that this was a decision that they planned. Like, I feel like it makes more sense in the moment. Like, you know, get Fuma back even for a few seconds, and he instantly is like screaming in guilt or something, and then your reaction is no. You're misremembering, I did it, or something. Like, it feels like a gut reaction one could do. It feels really strange as a, like, premeditated, this is how we're gonna handle this thing we don't even know is gonna happen yet. Like, it feels very much like cart before the horse. Like, what?
I agree. And I think it's always bothered me. Like, this is a moment that is very weird, and it will be interesting to see how the anime handles this, and, of course, interesting to see how this ends up playing out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we're good. I don't know if you have anything else to say. I guess I need to point out again that it is capitalism and not humanity that is ravaging the earth, Kusanagi.
Yeah, even he said, like, progress is not necessarily bad, but it's being done without consideration, basically.
Yes. He has his moment about that, and it's maybe less Kusanagi and more Kakyo that I'm yelling at here, but, like, It's fine. We'll get there. It's definitely one of the big discussions I want to have towards the end of this project, because I think that this sets up a very naive version of environmentalism that is outdated and confusing.
Yes, I agree.
All right. But again, that's for the future. That's not stargazing. I'm talking about our future. I can prognosticate our future. I just shouldn't be telling you guys about what happens next in the story that we have technically, supposedly not read. And I definitely get a point taken away for that for this week. That's I will just okay. accept this. I'm accepting this.
It's bound to happen. It's too hard. I mean, to be fair, I think we're a little safer now, at least for me, because my big danger was that I kept wanting to reference X when we were reading Reg Veda. And so now that we're in X, it's pretty much like the danger zone is gone for me.
If anything, we should be talking about Reg Veda even more than we are. And we'll probably rectify that. Like, again, as we get towards the end, some of the parallels will make more sense, too.
Yeah, and we've talked about maybe revisiting it at some point.
Yeah, it'll be good.
We rushed through that.
Look, we had a different idea of what our format was.
We did, it's fine.
Okay, speaking of our format and what we're doing, we are just going to continue with X for next week. It will be volume 10.
Yes.
And by next week, we do mean next episode. Oh my goodness, we do these like twice a month, not every other week. It's
oh god, we would die.
We would die.
If you for some reason missed the movie episode in which we announced the poll results, we did ask everybody what they would prefer as far as reading more X, switching to Ray Earth, etc. And the winner was finish X. So we are just going to finish X. This year is just going to be the year of X. And next year we'll get to have some lighter fare, which will be nice. And I hope
it's going to be magical girl year.
Yeah, I hope it's a statement on how the world will also be better next year.
Yes.
But we'll see. 2020 is only half done, so there's plenty of time still.
Oh my goodness. I don't want to talk about it, Lucy. Okay, tell us where people can follow us, though.
You can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at ClampCastPod, on Facebook as ClampCast in Wonderland, and on our website, ClampCastinWonderland.com. You can also join our Patreon, where we'll be releasing bonus episodes about classic anime and other things, and special things for you.
Thank you so much for everybody who has joined your Patreon. That is incredibly humbling and makes us want to work extra hard, and we've been trying.
We
have managed to get bonus episodes out. I'm really proud of us.
Yeah, and it's gonna be making the next few things we have to do a lot easier. That support on Patreon is gonna make things a lot more possible, so that's very exciting.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.